listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Anything Goes Summer Wednesday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. As we speak, tanks are rolling into or up to the presidential palace in Egypt. The state newspaper has said that a military takeover is happening. The actual phrase, a Morsi aide, President Morsi says a military coup is underway. So we will see how this thing plays out. We'll keep you up to date on it. If you have any particular unique perspectives, thoughts, experiences you'd like to share with regard to it, feel free to give us a shout. Meanwhile, down in Florida, the Zimmerman trial has people in America talking about race and racial conflict in a way that we really haven't seen since the O.J. Simpson trial almost 20 years ago. And that conversation about race is an important one. But it's time we did more than just analyze news stories. I mean, it's time to have a serious conversation about the long-term legacies of the Holocaust of slavery and its fellow travelers, poverty, and racism. The sad truth is that in modern American society, African Americans, and particularly young male African Americans like Trayvon Martin, are treated like criminals simply because of the color of their skin. Here's an example of how bad it is. During an appearance on CNN this week, LeVar Burton, you know, the host of Reading Rainbow, this is like an African-American Mr. Rogers, right? He talked about what it's like to be treated like a criminal by law enforcement and described how he avoids getting shot when he's pulled over by the cops.
So when I get stopped by the police, I take my hat off and my sunglasses off. I put them on the passenger side. I roll down my window. I take my hands. I stick them outside the window and on the door of the driver's side because I want that officer to be as relaxed as he can be when he approaches my vehicle. And I do that because I live in America.
That's right. The host of a children's show fears for his life every time he's pulled over for a routine traffic stop. Something that, by the way, a lot of white people have never even had happen in their lives. I doubt Captain Kangaroo or Mr. Rogers ever had to deal with something like that. If that doesn't demonstrate the lasting power of racism in American society, I don't know what does. The effect of this sort of ingrained racism cuts deep into our public policy. You don't need to look any farther than the nation's biggest city, New York, to see the evidence of it. In 2011, African Americans made up 53% of all people stopped under the NYPD's Stop and Frisk program, even though they only make up 23.5% of the city's population. White, Asian, and Native American New Yorkers, on the other hand, only make up 13% of stops, despite making up 47.3% of the population. If you think that's because the city's African American population is more likely to be involved in criminal activity when they're out walking around, then think again. Of the 2.3 million stops of African Americans from 2004 to 2012, 2.3 million, only 16,000 resulted in the seizures of illicit goods. That's a success rate for stop and frisk of 0.00069%. Not 1%, not 1/10 of a percent, not 1/100 of a percent, no, 6/1000 of a percent. That isn't policing. That's harassment. Last year, radio show host Joe Madison appeared on this show and told me what he told his son about how to deal with law enforcement.
There's not a day that when my son walks out that door, I had to tell my son in our neighborhood, be very careful. Now, don't move quickly. Don't say anything. Certainly, he's been taught to have respect for the law. This goes beyond having respect for law enforcement officials. This goes about you will be profiled. Be very careful. You will be followed.
White people have never had to tell their children this. It's not easy to talk about race, and it's certainly not easy to find an easy fix to all the problems that five centuries of racism causes. But that conversation is necessary. And the time to start that conversation is now. We like to think of America as a beacon of democracy because every day American citizens, African Americans, but every day American citizens, African Americans, have to endure the daily insults of endemic racism. And that's just wrong. I mean, it's just plain old flat out wrong. So, your thoughts on that, I guess I've shared mine with you. By the way, this is still on the floor of the United States Senate. On February 28th, the Senate proposed a bill to avoid the sequester. That bill included elimination of tax subsidies to big oil, closing loopholes for companies that ship jobs overseas, and lowering itemized deductions on incomes over $4 million. Senate Bill 388, the American Family Economic Protection Act of 2013. Every single Republican voted against it. Cut big oil subsidies, close loopholes for companies that ship jobs overseas, do away with loopholes, tax loopholes on deductions over $4 million. Every single Republican voted against it. Pepsi is continuing to make their product with 4-methylimidazole, 4-MEI. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing the chemical name. This is the black coloring that's in Pepsi. Turns out it causes lung tumors in mice. Interesting story about it today on the front page of the Financial Times. And I wanted to get into, and this I've been talking about doing this for some time. I just want to get into the issue of peace. Consider, this war that George W. Bush has brought us, this kind of never-ending war and all this kind of thing. And just wanted to talk about peace. John Kennedy gave a speech at Michigan State University back when I was a kid. I wasn't there and didn't hear it, but it's, we have a recording of it. And he talked about peace. Here he is.
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth, peace.
The most important topic on earth.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave, or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow, and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
Peace in all time. And, what was Kennedy talking about when he was talking about this peace? This is, in my opinion, one of his best speeches ever. I mean, he devoted this entire speech to peace. He in this speech, and I'll play more of it after the break. He talks about supporting the United Nations. He talks about there is literally no country, no people who are so evil that they don't deserve some respect from us and that they don't deserve peace. It was a complete repudiation of George W. Bush's whole, we're going to get them, we're going to kill them, we're going to bomb, Afghanistan, Iraq, the whole thing. A complete repudiation of that doctrine. It's an absolutely brilliant speech that I think we need to hear again as we're looking at the possibility of worldwide conflict in this moment. We'll be back with more.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Meanwhile, in Egypt, the tanks are moving on the presidential palace. Yeah, I just quit on it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. John Kennedy, I just, for a few minutes here, just let's step into the Wayback Machine. Given all the conflicts around the world, given, President Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize. in anticipation, I would submit, that he was going to wind down and end George Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, unnecessary, illegal wars that led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, the displacement and destroying the lives of millions of people, generations of birth defects and post-traumatic stress disorder and families ripped apart, and an entire region that has learned to hate America because of the actions of this, you know, small cabal of war criminals in the George W. Bush administration. But Jack Kennedy, back in the 1960s, this was June 10th, 1963, right around this time, you know, the summer of 1963, pushing back, and it actually, 63, that was 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 63, that'd be 50 years ago. Yeah. Pushing back on the idea of war. Here he is.
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task.
And there really is no more urgent task, and we need to...
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
Yet we killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis.
Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility.
At least they were until John
Bolton. For we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute.
Unless you're George Bush.
Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished.
And then he promised we'd never start a war.
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
Yes. Keep in mind, I mean, this is a guy who fought in World War II, whose PT ship was, you know, cut in half and or blown up and you know, rescued his guys and was, you know, stuck in the Pacific. I mean, he this is a guy who really knew war, from a generation that knew war. His older brother, Joe Kennedy, who was supposed to be president, run for president, at least in his dad's mind, his older brother was killed in World War II. So this was somebody who understood what he was speaking of.
We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
There you go. So, yeah, you can. I know there are going to be cynics who are going to say, yeah, he was saying that while he was trying to kill Castro and he was sending some soldiers into Vietnam. Sure. You can be as cynical as you wish. And yet, he began the conversation. And he was actually trying to work out peace with Castro. And he did avoid a world war with Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this is not to deify John Kennedy. In fact, it's not even to really comment on his presidency, because, you know, he had his share of screw-ups. He was certainly no George W. Bush. Oh, yeah, let's have a war. Let's just bomb some people. You know, that's night and day. But the point is that, I mean, this is sort of like, you know, Obama's speech the other day about, you know, no longer contributing to global warming, and then saying, but natural gas is wonderful, without mentioning fracking. You can take a cynical response to it. You can say, yeah, you know, it's, you know, good words, but the fact of the matter is that at least the conversation has been joined. Instead of having a president who is constantly telling us to be afraid, as Richard Nixon had done during the Cold War, back when he was president, and before that when he was vice president, be afraid of the Soviets, be afraid of the Vietnamese, be afraid of the Chinese, be afraid of, you know, duck and cover. Be afraid. George W. Bush, be afraid of the Muslims. Start a crusade. They want to build a caliphate. Oh, my God, look out. Instead of having a president who's saying, be afraid, John Kennedy was saying, no, we can be the land of the free and the home of the brave. We can stand strong and advocate for peace. There have been times during this, during the history, during our lifetimes, specifically during the Bush-Cheney, Rumsfeld, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, Alberto Gonzalez, Condoleezza Rice war criminal administration, when people who spoke out in favor of peace were, you know, actively booted off the air. Bill Donahue out of MSNBC. Bill Maher thrown off, I think it was ABC. Simply because they said, war? You really want a war? No, I don't think so. So let's engage the conversation. Let's engage the conversation about peace. Let's engage the conversation about global warming. Let's begin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And let's engage the conversation about race at the George Zimmerman trial. There's all these opportunities for important conversations now. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you on Anything Goes Summer Wednesday. Steve in River Forest, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Steve, you want to talk about race?
Yeah, Tom, I heard a geneticist being interviewed by Neil Conan on NPR, and he said that there's more genetic variation in sub-Saharan Africa than the rest of the planet combined.
It's true.
It blew my mind, because that means that just because you look like somebody doesn't mean you're the same as them. And race is kind of a bogus concept.
Yeah, race is an entirely bogus concept. There are genes that make up the individual components of what we call race, color of skin, color of eyes, you know, nature and color of hair, things like that. But those are individual genetic markers that can be passed along, you know, from father to son, mother to daughter, mother to son, yeah, all of the above, you know, from generation to generation. And but there is no one gene for race. There is no gene that says, aha, that makes you this. And you're absolutely right. Race is a bogus concept. Jim in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for calling. You know, you were talking about President Kennedy and his initiative for peace. But wasn't he the president that overthrew the Vietnamese government, Ngo Diem, and his brother?
No.
I mean, we were already involved in Vietnam before he was killed.
We were involved in Vietnam, yes, and it wasn't a good thing. But the guy who really put that on steroids was Lyndon Johnson, who is also a Democrat and you know, also has good and bad parts to his legacy. I spent most of my teenage years shouting, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? So I certainly was no fan of Lyndon Johnson then. In retrospect, I think his war on poverty was a damn good program. But the fact of the matter is that Harry Enrique Ruiz Williams, who was one of the two leaders of the Bay of Pigs and was very close to the Kennedy family, after Jack Kennedy was killed, I interviewed Harry for a book that Lamar Waldron and I wrote called Legacy of Secrecy that hopefully will be made into a movie this fall with Leo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. And in that interview, when I was talking with Harry, there was a coup that was supposed to happen in Cuba on December 5th that was being in part orchestrated and participated in by a fellow by the name of Almeida, Juan Almeida, who was the number three man. He was the head of the military in Cuba, the number three man in Cuba. He's just died in the last couple of years, so we could name him in our book. But, you know, this was an active military, U.S. military operation right up until about a decade ago. And so the first version of our book, we actually couldn't name him, as it was still a CIA, you know, top secret thing. And so Harry, after Kennedy was assassinated in late November of 63, Harry and a few other people went into President Johnson's office, into the Oval Office, and sat down with him and said, we still have the people in place to have this coup on December 5th, 1963, and in Cuba, and you're going to have a guy who's pro-American but also wants Cuba to be independent. No more mafia down there, no more America owns Cuba stuff, but an independent democracy off our coast. We're ready to do that. And Johnson, of course, had been badly, Kennedy had been badly burned by the Bay of Pigs thing, you know, which was something that Nixon had started in 1960 as an October surprise against Kennedy. And Kennedy didn't even know about it until maybe 1962. And so Lyndon Johnson just went off on him. Harry told me that Lyndon started screaming obscenities about those blanking Cubans and said, you know, he didn't want to have anything to do with Cuba. It was now at that point in time, Lyndon Johnson was still quite suspicious that Fidel Castro had something to do with the assassination of Kennedy. And this is just a week after the assassination. And anyhow, Lyndon Johnson went off on the Cubans. And then he said, I'm going to make my stand against communism as far as, blankety blank, as I can get from this continent. I'm going to do it in Vietnam. And because you had to, if you were a Democratic politician, Democratic president, the Republicans were so good at stirring up fear of communism that if you didn't plant some flag in the soil that was like, you know, yes, I'm fighting communists, you would just get mowed down in the elections. And so it was Lyndon Johnson who made that decision. He made that decision in early December of 1963. And, you know, I don't remember the exact date of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, but that was really what kicked off the war in Vietnam. You could say that Kennedy sort of set it up, but, you know, we had troops in a lot of different countries, and particularly in Central America. I mean, we've been messing around down there, the CIA, the ITT plots. I mean, go back and Google it for a long, long time. So, anyhow, thanks for the call. Brent in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Brent.
Hey, thank you. Listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
Maybe you can probably thank me after we go over this topic, because you still want to do that. Ever since World War II, I feel like ultimately due to failing to see the long-term consequences of their actions, every American conflict is actually the fault of liberals.
Okay, so, well, you know, I'll give you Harry Truman and Korea, although North Korea did attack South Korea, as I recall.
Well, I think ultimately it goes farther back than that. World War II... 75%. How did the United States pay for 75% of World War II? War bonds.
Debt.
That was the last major conflict. I'm sorry?
Yeah, debt. We borrowed money.
Yeah, that was the last time the United States ever really had war bonds. Why? Because of income tax. Because we implemented income tax, the government no longer needs to actually ask the United States people for money to conduct their wars. Instead, they simply take the money they want and do with it what they want. And if anyone refuses to...
But that's not true of George W. Bush's wars. He just borrowed the money. He didn't raise taxes on anybody. George W. Bush, in 8 years, ran up $5 trillion worth of debt because of his wars.
That's very interesting. But that you're forgetting one thing. That money was borrowed in the good credit of the United States based on their ability to raise that credit, based on their ability to tax people.
Okay.
They lend money to the United States.
Brent, if your logic is that because we have a mechanism in place that can be used to pay for wars, therefore the people who put that mechanism in place are responsible for wars, I think that you need to go back and have a conversation with George Washington, who was the first president to tax the American people. Now, granted, he did it mostly through tariffs. Maybe with Abraham Lincoln, he was the first president to impose an actual tax on income, an income tax. But you could make the same argument that because we have an income tax, we have fill in the blank. I mean, anything. We have an EPA. We have unemployment insurance. We have it doesn't make it bad, and it doesn't draw a direct line of responsibility. I respectfully reject your premise.
$600 billion defense industry.
I beg your pardon?
But I don't think we would have a $600 billion defense industry.
I think that the $600 billion defense industry, which I deplore, it more easily can be tracked to the Supreme Court's doctrine that it is okay for corporations to buy politicians, invest in politicians, shall we say, because money is equal to speech and corporations enjoy protections as persons under the Constitution of the United States, constitutional protections. And if you did away with those things so that Lockheed and Boeing Booz Allen Hamilton, Carlyle Group, whatever, that these companies could no longer buy their own favorite politicians, you wouldn't have a $600 billion industry, defense industry. And that's the original sin, which gets us back to movetoamend.org. Thanks a lot for the call, Brent. Jade in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jade.
Hey, I think the problem is, and I do believe you're part of it, is that once you have a position on something, it's hard to have an open mind.
Right.
Okay, Bush was president. It's not his war. Yeah, he was the president. He ordered the troops. But I got to tell you, I was one of those people who, I'm not big for war. But when 9/11 happened, you better believe I was one of those people saying they need to pay for it. So if
so, Iraq had to pay for 9/11?
Well, let me ask you, is Vietnam Kennedy's war? You know,
Iraq had to pay for 9/11? Really?
No, Orlando. What about Afghanistan? Were we in war there?
Well, Afghanistan offered George W. Bush. They offered to arrest Osama bin Laden and shut down his camps.
Didn't the Somalians offer?
And hand him over to a third party. And George W. Bush said, no, thank you. We'd rather bomb your country.
Well, you know, Clinton also said no thank you when the Somalians offered Osama bin Laden, who is the major architect.
I don't recall that. I do recall very clearly, though, during the Monica Lewinsky hearings, that Clinton threw three cruise missiles into bin Laden's camp in Afghanistan and missed him by a half hour. And the Republicans went to the floor of the House to say that Clinton was trying to wag he was the tail that was trying to wag the dog to avoid the conversation about Monica Lewinsky.
Is all these presidents... And let me tell you, I can't judge a president because there's no way I've ever been a president. I haven't had to deal with what they deal with. And it's so easy for us to do that, to sit there and play armchair president and pick apart everything.
But see, we have no choice, Jade. Because we vote and we pick presidents, we have to do that. Now, I also note here that you said something about George Zimmerman.
Okay, yeah, George Zimmerman. All right, here's a guy. I don't know if he's innocent or guilty. All right.
Of what?
Killing me of the crime of the second degree murder that he's been charged of.
Okay. Because he's confessed to having had shot Trayvon Martin, yeah, which led to his death.
Right. He admitted he did it that. But the part that's killing me is that the way the media is, and it happens on both sides of the media, because there's two sides to the media. You know, why not give the honest interpretation of what was said instead of all the extra stuff?
Well, because nobody knows. Now, my personal take on what's going to happen with the crime, which is completely independent of my take on how this all came about and what should be done, is that the prosecution should have charged Zimmerman with manslaughter. I think that there's a very good chance he's going to get off on second-degree murder because the bar of proof is so high, is so steep, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's going to be a disaster if that happens. Jade, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it's going to be a disaster because, Trayvon Martin was just walking along, right, in a neighborhood that he had every right to be in. And George Zimmerman's chased him with a gun. There should be something about that. General Abdul Fattah el-Sisi has spoken on Egyptian television. He's the head of the military that just overthrew the Morsi government. Mr. Morsi, this is semi-hysterically funny. Given the topic, over at the Daily Kos, they've got the event and then a couple of tweets about it. In Tahrir Square, that Morsi's been overthrown. And then Hayes Brown tweets, Karl Rove says there's still time for Morsi to pull ahead. It all comes down to crucial Waukesha County. And then here's the question. This the AP tweeted, and you have to wonder, is Morsi with Dick Cheney someplace? Morsi's aide says Egyptian leader has been moved to an undisclosed location. All right. Okay. But the New York Times is reporting that the army has ousted the Egyptian president, that he has been moved to an undisclosed location. Right now there are fireworks going on over the sky in Cairo, or there were a few minutes ago, as in, let's celebrate. Let's not have a battle here. People are cheering the tanks in Tahrir Square. No word that I have seen that the Morsi supporters are rioting or that there is violence there. The opposition protesters, yeah, the Tahrir Square. So, you know, we're watching history being made as we speak and listening to it being made. So we'll see where this goes. We live in interesting times, my friends. Gerald in Belafonte, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gerald. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, thanks, Tom. I just wanted to give you a heads up. I got a robocall about 2 weeks ago from, I'm assuming it was defense industry, because they said, do you know that Obama cut defense seriously and now he's making a humongous bureaucracy for the health care? And I wanted to, if it would have been a person, I would have said, yeah, but he didn't cut enough.
Yeah, it sounds like they're a Republican Party.
I don't think it was a Republican Party. I think it was some defense industry.
Were they asking you questions? Was it a survey, or did they just call you and make a statement and hang up?
No, it was called basic. Well, I should have listened to the whole thing, but I got disgusted and hung up.
I see.
But the whole thing is, I think somebody's afraid that we'll actually get peace.
Actually have peace?
Yeah.
Yeah. Peace is not profitable. Peace is not something that the people who move the levers of power here in Washington, D.C., are in fans of or in favor of. And presidents speak of peace at their own risk, frankly. So I'm with you, Gerald. I'm with you. Thanks for the call and the heads up. Stephen in Weiser, Idaho. Hey, Stephen. The Electoral College?
Yes. Could I make a comment on an earlier call?
Certainly.
I have the disability of brain damage, but I'm kind of smart, I think. But you said there's was talking about race, and there's one race. I go long gone bipedal apes, as Homo Neanderthalensis, aka Neanderthals, and Homo erectus, and Homo ergaster, Homo boisingi, and Homo forensis, all those other homos, other races of homos.
Yes.
And there's one race of homo left, and we're not Homo sapiens. Our stock name is Homo sapiens sapiens, because Homo is just one sapiens, had smaller brains, wider space eyes, were shorter in stature, and had a greater breadth of webbed hands and toes than us. We are formerly aquatic bipedal apes. That's why my brother has webbed toes. It's called Cyrenomelia.
Mm-hmm.
When members of our species are born with mermaid tails minus the fish scales, we're the only surviving primate with a layer of fat, aka blubber, directly beneath their skin. Our species built swimming pools everywhere we go. Sometimes females have babies underneath water, aka water births.
Yeah.
And our FDA recently classified omega-3 fats in fish as a heart-healthy substance.
No, Stephen, I've talked about this on the air. I actually think that the aquatic ape hypothesis makes a lot of sense. And I think that it indicates that at some point in the history of the human race, there was a bottleneck event, a Stephen Jay Gould-type bottleneck event, where probably some sort of massive global warming event happened, perhaps associated with volcanic activity. And at that time, the humans who survived might have just been a few thousand of us, and that we probably survived by standing in water up to our necks for a couple of generations.
No, it doesn't go like that. I don't know.
Okay.
I think where the Sahara Desert currently is, used to be a big old wet swamp and rainforest.
Yeah.
Some of the modern day Amazon. But when the lighter subcontinent India begins slamming into the heavier subcontinent Eurasia, the resulting mountain range called the Himalayas stole precipitation once destined for Sahara. It's called rain shadow, and why West Cascade Mountains, Oregon, and Washington's all wet, and East is pretty dry. And like we were in the water for lots of generations, like the ancestor modern day hippos, elephants, rhinos, domestic pigs, their ancestors obviously lived in the same environment as we did.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to look like that of we.
Yeah, there's semi-aquatic mammals.
Just like today, sometimes kids are born with mermaid tails, Cyrenomelia.
Right.
I'm sure that when we're landlocked marine mammals, our ancestors occasionally born bipedal. I'm thinking that our species speciated into warrior biped class to battle off fellow homos.
Okay.
That was his parents.
Stephen, we are probably losing 80% of our listeners who have no idea what we're talking about. You wanted to talk about the Electoral College?
Can I do the Electoral College?
You may. We have 60 seconds.
It goes, a good college. I'm writing about our Electoral College. How we elect the President of the United States of North America, then parentheses, us and A as I pronounce capital U.S., apostrophe capital N.A. for short. The Electoral College should not be abolished. It just needs a simple addition. The popular vote of us and A needs to have a say in the
Stephen, are you
college.
Reading something? Because it's
brain damage. Can I please read it?
It's hard to understand you when you read. If you could just tell us what you wanted to say.
Okay, keep the Electoral College as it is,
right.
But, like, give the popular vote 25 votes to Electoral College. Someone will bring California's high and Idaho's low. That way every state and us and A as a whole be clamoring for candidates' attention. That way folks that live in a state dominated by one political party.
Well, you know about the movement to say that states, once 289 or whatever it is electoral votes have, states representing that many electoral votes have agreed to this, that a whole bunch of states have said, whatever the majority of the Electoral College votes for, we will throw our electors for. I mean, this is kind of the national popular vote movement. You're familiar with this, I'm assuming.
Yeah, give the popular vote 25 votes to the Electoral College.
Yeah. Okay. Stephen, thank you for the call. We will be back. It's coming up at 4 o'clock here on the East Coast, top of the hour. Stick around. Anything goes. Oh, Debbie Hines is going to drop by.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, we opened the last hour with a bit of a rant about how the issue, how the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, the Trayvon Martin murder trial of George Zimmerman has opened a conversation about race in this country, which I think is long overdue and very important. But then there's the trial itself as well. Debbie Hines is with us. She is a trial lawyer, former prosecutor, legal political commentator over at LegalSpeaks.com, and has been sharing with us her thoughts on what's going on with the trial, but watching it very carefully. Debbie, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be back.
First question. This is a kind of a technical question, but I've been hearing a lot of commentary. I've been, actually paying a fair amount of attention to this, and that suggests that second-degree murder is a very high bar for this prosecution to hit, and that by not going for manslaughter, which would have been probably more of a slam dunk, they may blow the case. On the other hand, Shano, our associate producer here, who has a law degree, found some information suggesting that in Florida, it is possible to embed into the jury instructions or into the prosecutor's brief a request for, if the jury can't find the person guilty of a higher charge, a lesser charge. Do you know how that's playing out with regard to this trial and whether that's possible in the jurisdiction that this is being prosecuted in?
Well, they've charged second-degree murder. In most jurisdictions, even when you do charge first-degree murder, and that is the primary charge, the jury can still find, under the judge's instruction, second-degree murder or manslaughter. It doesn't work its way up. So if the prosecution had charged manslaughter, the jury could not have found second-degree murder. It doesn't work up. It works down.
Right, but they still have the option of defaulting back to manslaughter if they can't come to a second-degree murder conviction.
That is my understanding, yes.
Okay.
I'm not licensed in Florida. I just want to give that caveat, but that is my understanding, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that seems to make sense. So what's I've been on the air for a couple of hours and show prep, I haven't seen what's happened most recently in the trial. Where is it? What's going on?
Well, today is the day, Judge Zimmerman. The judge, Deborah Nelson, says this is the day that the state ends their case. So however late they have to go today, she said they're going to end their case today. They only have a few witnesses left. Presumably, Sabrina Fulton would be the last witness, and the witness that was just on, for which right now they're doing the cross-examination on, is the DNA expert. And that was really very interesting.
Mm. What did the DNA experts say that was interesting?
Well, the DNA, there's been all this talk about, you've heard in the opening that there wasn't really any blood that was found, but then you're looking at the pictures of George Zimmerman. He's clearly got a bloody nose and his head's bashed up, but there is no blood that was found on Trayvon Martin of George Zimmerman. And that's pretty much what the DNA expert has said, is that there isn't really any blood on Trayvon Martin from George Zimmerman, if he had been really punching him and beating him.
Yeah, does that not suggest that, I mean, we now know that George Zimmerman had taken classes in the law. He understood the law. He understood what a self-defense defense was, and he understood stand your ground and all this other stuff. Does that mean that it's possible that after George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin, he then smashed his own head into the sidewalk or went home and said to somebody, punch me a few times and make it look really good before I call the police?
No, he didn't go home. I mean, they found him on the spot. I mean, the police were on the way, and if he just waited, Trayvon Martin would still be living. The police came, and they found him on the spot. And I don't think it's any doubt that, you know, there was a tussle, there was a fight, and that he hit his head on the ground. I mean, and the medical examiner had testified that actually the marks that you see on the back of his head, that they were very superficial marks. They required a Band-Aid. They did not require stitches. And even though Zimmerman had said that, oh, he beat him repeatedly, he had his head pounding and pounding and pounding repeatedly against the cement, the medical examiner said, well, no, I think all of this could have happened with just one blow.
So it could be that George Zimmerman just tripped and fell.
He had some injuries from the head, and it was probably from the fight, but there is still the question of, you know, the nose issue and all this blood that he's saying actually occurred. The scientific evidence does not support that.
If you punch somebody in the nose hard enough to break their nose, you are going to end up with blood and skin on your fingers.
Right. And it's not there.
And it's not there on Trayvon Martin's fingers. So how did George Zimmerman's nose get broken?
I don't think we have to know. I mean, now you're actually sounding like a juror. I don't think we have to know how it happened. I think we just have to know it did not happen the way he said it happened.
Right. Right. Which makes me very suspicious.
I mean, it didn't happen the way he said it happened. And it's really good about the DNA evidence, because that's the one thing that people that are watching TV, the jurors, they watch their shows. I mean, everybody thinks there's always this DNA evidence that's going to break the case. And in a way, this DNA evidence does really help to support that. Whatever happened, and we're never going to know the really complete full picture, because both parties cannot testify, but what we do know is it did not happen the way the defendant says it happened.
Right, which impeaches the defendant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Also, there was gun testimony. I heard part of that this morning while I was home doing show prep, where the gun expert said that George Zimmerman walked into this thing with an active shell in the chamber.
Right. No doubt about that.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with firearms, and one of my brothers is a sport target shooter. You know, we don't have any hunters or anything in our family, but and you just don't do that. You don't walk around with a hot shell in the chamber unless you're really planning on using it imminently.
And that goes back to the theme that the state has, that this person, this defendant, he was a wannabe cop. So it goes consistently for him that that's why he would do it. I mean, the average person is not really going to do that, because they don't want to have a family member hurt or, you know, an innocent person hurt by having a gun, by having the available in the chamber. But this was a person who saw himself as a cop.
Right. So he was...
He was ready. He was armed and ready.
Yeah. And more than ready. He was basically half-cocked. I mean, not fully cocked. Well, actually, you could say it was fully cocked, because all he had to do was pull the trigger, and
right.
boom.
Right, and that was some other testimony that was really very interesting. And I know that all of this will get really pieced together when the prosecution does the closing arguments. But with respect to the gun, what they were saying is that in order, the particular gun that he had, you had to really pull back on the gun for it to fire. They explained in a lot more technical detail than we probably can discuss, but the point being that if Zimmerman was on the bottom and he's being beat by Trayvon Martin, it raises the question, would he really be able to, with that particular weapon, to be able to pull back the length that he needed to pull back because he's already allegedly flat on the ground?
Right, right. I'm curious about just a quick question about Rachel Gentel, was it?
Yeah, Rachel Gentel, yes.
I recently learned that English was her third language, that she speaks Creole and that she spoke either French or Spanish.
She speaks Haitian Creole, she speaks Spanish, and she speaks English.
I mean, that radically increased my respect for her. I thought she was being treated very poorly by the prosecution to begin with. Does the jury know that?
I'm trying to think how that... Yes, they do, because I'm not sure if it came out on redirect with the prosecution, but she was saying it did come out that she speaks at home, and it probably came out on cross-examination as I'm thinking it through, but she made it clear that she speaks Haitian Creole at home to her mother, and she does speak English and she speaks Spanish. That did come out because Don West was trying to make her seem like she's a moron.
Right, an inarticulate moron, yeah. And people who speak three languages. Really? Okay, Debbie Hines, a trial lawyer, former prosecutor, legal political commentator over at LegalSpeaks.com. Debbie, thank you for being with us
today. Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Really appreciate your insights. It's great to have somebody we can go to who knows this stuff. Thank you again. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, thoughts on the Trayvon Martin trial? How does it seem like it's playing out to you so far? Egypt, what's going on there? I'll share my thoughts after. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And Randy in Brooklyn, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am well, thank you. How are you?
Fine. Little chill, and you didn't have a lot of patience to call your radio station. In any case, what I wanted you to comment on was the race factor. I mean, days of utopia, talking about,
Hey, Randy, if you've got me on a speakerphone, can you take it off speakerphone, please?
Yes, I can.
Because it's hard for me to understand what you're saying. I'm sorry. There's just so much echo in it.
Yes, I took you off speakerphone.
Okay, great.
I was thinking, we're living a utopia about a race, like it should be like one race, but what this is not what the world is about. It's not different races, and then racism do exist, and no matter how we could dream of a world without racism, it's not just
sure.
Not gonna happen.
Yeah,
and. You have, going back to the Trayvon Martin case, and George Zimmerman was instructed to remain inside. So, yeah, they could, the defense may look whatever way around now, saying, he was on a job, or was, he, as you just, I just heard you commented, if he was white, that boy with Trayvon Martin was right, he would not be killed now. He would not be dead now.
That's right. That's my belief. And go ahead.
No, it's he saw a black boy out there, and he was armed. I mean, he was ready and able. He was so he went out there and they started a fight. Nothing else but that.
Yep. And somebody died. And the person who starts the fight, the person who does the stalking, the person who's racially profiling, the person who's muttering under his breath about these people. That's the guy who survived, and the guy who was the kid who was armed with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea is the one who died. And today we learned from the trial, from the DNA expert, that there was none of George Zimmerman's DNA on Trayvon Martin's hands, which means the whole story of him bashing George Zimmerman's head into the cement and beating him up and punching him and breaking his nose was a plain old flat-out lie, which raises a whole lot of questions about how did George Zimmerman sustain those injuries. Were they self-inflicted as a way of trying to create a defense, a self-defense, and a lot of other things? And I'm very suspicious of those things. Randy, thank you for the call. Thanks for your perspective. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, On page 10 of Environment and Climate News, there's a story about the 97% scientist degree thing, and it turns out that that whole study by, I think it was John Cook, turned out to be a fraud, according to Greg Izzo and...
Yeah, Steve, I would not put much stock in those publications that are generated by the Koch brothers and the big oil industries and the other fossil fuel polluters. If you were old enough to remember the tobacco debates 30 years ago, the tobacco industry was pumping out the exact same stuff. And in some cases, it's even the same bought and paid scientists, although they're much older now.
So in other words, George Soros is... scientists are correct in the
George Soros I don't think has a dog in this fight. The actual scientists who actually do science for a living, who spent their entire lives becoming climate scientists or geologists or whatever their particular physicists, whatever their discipline may be, yeah, they know what they're talking about, and they're saying global warming is real and it represents a genuine threat to the human race. And you know, you can have all the paid shills you want from the Koch brothers and the other oil barons. It doesn't stop. It doesn't explain why 9 out of the last 10 years have been the hottest in history since we started keeping records in 1850. Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jason. HSBC?
Hey, yeah, that's what I was going to comment about.
Go for it.
This is another example here. You know, since the Obama administration's been in power here, we've jailed maybe 2 or 3 people, whereas during the SNL crisis, we jailed hundreds of people that were involved in that. And I think it's very important when you're making these announcements about the news in this, you should say another failure by the Obama administration to rein in Wall Street.
Yep.
Is failure again to allow. And I think it's just really important because I think what happens is if this was a Bush administration, I think the tone would have been a little bit different. And this is just a crime against everybody here. This isn't a Republican or a Democratic thing. This is just a basically the laws aren't getting enforced and crimes are being committed. Whereas if some guy steals an apple from a grocery store, he's going to get more jail time and more, you know,
than any of these banksters. No, I totally agree with you, Jason. This has been one of the biggest failures of the Obama administration, is their failure and their unwillingness to prosecute these banksters. Elizabeth Warren brought this out in Congress, and you know, when she was questioning members of the Obama administration, people who were supposed to be regulating these banks, and saying, well, why did you cut a deal with these guys? And they're saying, well, it was the best way to get this thing off the books. And like, well, why not prosecute them? What's wrong with prosecuting? Well, it would have just produced the same result. Well, maybe it would have, you know, and Elizabeth Warren just took this administration apart. And it's one of the reasons why I would love to see her run for president in 2016.
Yeah, it also is just a disturbing aspect to me is just the fact that how I hear people on the left in particular, they're very apologetic about this, like, you know, somehow they're going along with this. Like, you know,
yeah, well, you've not heard that here.
Yeah, well, I understand that, and that's part of the thing that I just, you know, I find this duplicity between, you know, Republicans who say they're fiscal conservatives and then they completely go the other way, and liberals on one side saying that they're all for civil liberties, and the Obama administration's, you know, shredding the Constitution with the Fourth Amendment,
yeah.
And you don't hear that too much about it.
We need to be waking up in a completely transpartisan way. This is the politics has been so corrupted by money. We need to say, corporations are not people. Money is not speech. We need to undo this insane Supreme Court doctrine. We've got the Roberts Court, which is the most, arguably the most activist United States Supreme Court in history. And if you add Bush v. Gore, and Roberts was not on the bench at that time, that was Rehnquist, but if you add that to it, I mean, this last 2 decades of this Supreme Court has been definitely the most, I mean, no Supreme Court before it ever picked a president for us. It's insane. So, Jason, I'm with you. The too big to fail has become too big to jail, and too big to jail is plain old simple too big. And the Obama administration needs to take on these banks, and they need to take on the military-industrial spy complex.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And thank God for people like Elizabeth Warren with regard to the banks and Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon with regard to the NSA. We need more of them. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Oh, my. So far, still no, and let's hope it continues this way, no significant eruptions of violence in Egypt. And so far, the Trayvon Martin trial is continuing. This is the last day of the prosecution's presenting their case. And they just presented DNA evidence that Trayvon Martin did not punch George Zimmerman in the face and did not smash his head into the cement, which raises some very interesting questions about where did he get that broken nose and how come the back of his head is injured, although yesterday or the day before, the medical examiner said the injuries to George Zimmerman were superficial, small, and didn't even require stitches, just took a Band-Aid. So, anyhow. John in Morristown, New Jersey. Hey, John, you wanted to talk about the Zimmerman trial?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for taking my call. First of all, I just would like to offer a correction. And I've heard this called this way on several talk shows, including yours. It is actually not the Trayvon Martin trial.
Mm-hmm.
It is the Don Zimmerman trial. And that has
George
the way it's phrased.
Yes.
I'm sorry?
George Zimmerman. But yes, you're right.
It is, and I just would hope that the public are not sensing that Trayvon Martin's on trial for anything, but the more we say that, that becomes a connotation in the minds of folks. So I'd just like to offer that.
I think that the reason, John, why I can tell you the reason why I mentioned Trayvon Martin in the context of George Zimmerman is that Trayvon's name went far and wide. Everybody recognizes Trayvon Martin's name. Not so much so with George Zimmerman. And although that is amping up. So when you want to get somebody's attention and have them know what trial you're talking about, you say, I mean, technically what you should say is George Zimmerman's trial for the second degree murder of Trayvon Martin. And
I think that works best.
Yeah. And I will try to do that. You're welcome. Thank you. I will be trying to be sensitive to that. I think it's a good point. Because Trayvon Martin, although as much as the defense is actually trying to put Trayvon Martin on trial and trying to say that he somehow provoked this and was, you know, he deserved it and all that kind of, it's nonsense. And it is the trial of George Zimmerman. You're right. Excellent point. Janet in Gustine, California. Hey, Janet, you want to talk about methane?
Yeah, but first I'd like to ask you, what happened to Higgins?
Oh, Higgins. Higgins has apparently hyperthyroidism. And when we got him home, Louise pulled out the receipt because he was walking around bouncing into walls because they had to knock him out in order to draw blood from him because he was just like so. I mean, maybe 6-8 years ago we took him into a vet, and that vet was so convinced that Higgins was an out of control wildcat that he was telling us, he told Louise he wasn't going to give her back, that he was just going to put the cat down. And she had to walk into the back room and pick up Higgins and all, you know, and Higgins just, oh, great, glad to see you. Whereas he'd just been, like, taking out anybody else who tried to get near him. So anyhow, we looked at the drug list, and they had given him a benzodiazepine drug of the Valium family drug. They had given him a barbiturate, I forget which one, and it was like a butabarbital kind of thing. And they had given him ketamine. Ketamine is the paralytic that Michael Jackson died from an overdose of that they use for surgery to just, you know, knock people out and freeze their body in place. And it took all three drugs to get Higgins down to the point where they could get blood out of him. So anyhow, he seems to have recovered from that. And when the blood work came back, they said he has an overactive thyroid. And they gave us three choices. You could zap his thyroid with radiation, you could give him a drug that knocks down his thyroid, or you could put him on a no-iodine diet. And we have chosen the latter, the third, and there's a special cat food that we bought $150 worth of. It's insanely expensive because you have to have a prescription for it. It doesn't have any iodine in it, doesn't have any kelp in it. And so Higgins is on an iodine-free diet, and hopefully within 3 or 4 weeks, he's already behaving better. They gave him a little bit of Pepcid AC, I guess it is. And, in fact, they said, you know, you could break a Pepcid AC tablet into little pieces and he won't barf as much. And he hasn't thrown up in 3 days. So I think he's getting better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I hadn't heard anything about it.
Yeah, that's the Higgins update. Thank you for asking and caring.
Well, anyway, I wanted to ask about what the scientific community is saying about methane. The ice is melting around the Arctic, and they're saying I don't know. I guess this is true. That half-mile swaths of methane is going into the air.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that?
Methane is an incredibly dangerous greenhouse gas. It exists for a relatively short period of time, a couple of decades, And when it degrades into one atom or molecule of methane, becomes four molecules of carbon dioxide. And but it's very, very potent. It's like 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And if you consider that over periods of time and you consider the rate of release, it can be argued that it's as much as 100 times more potent or less than 20 times, depending on the rate of release. But yes, the big concern, the big wild card right now, and I've interviewed several scientists about this over the last week on videotape, and we're putting together a piece for this that we will be rolling out in August that just kind of compiles all these interviews. But what I'm hearing from scientist after scientist is that they're scared silly about the possibility that the Arctic permafrost and the Siberian permafrost, the Arctic permafrost being the permafrost that's just under the seabed where it's been frozen for millennia, and the Siberian permafrost, the permafrost on land, that these things melt, and as they melt, they have stored within them hundreds of billions of tons, gigatons, of frozen methane, methane hydrate, methane clathrate, it's called, and that when this methane melts, it will go into the atmosphere, and we will see a spike in global warming that could be extinction event levels, that could be, I mean, we're not just talking about the ocean going up 10 feet. We're talking about, you know, wiping out large chunks of life on the Earth.
Was,
so,
was the sea ice preventing the methane coming through?
Or yes, the sea ice was doing two things. One, it was increasing what's called the albedo effect of the planet. Because the sea ice is white and reflects light, it was reflecting back out into outer space an awful lot of radiated light and heat. And when it's replaced by blue open water absorbs light and heat, and so the ocean warms even faster. So that produces one of those runaway positive feedback loops, which are not good things. And then secondly, by capping the ocean, it was keeping the cold in the ocean so that the warm air above it was not warming the ocean, because the Arctic is warming four times faster than the equator is. The Earth does not warm evenly. The Arctic has already warmed about 2 degrees Celsius. The land masses in where we are, or the world average, is about 0.8 degrees and Celsius, about 1.5 degrees, a little more than 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And so there's a lot of concern about this, that this could be a tipping point. And when you look at the other mass extinctions in the history of the Earth, the Permian end mass extinction being the biggest, 90% of all life on Earth died. It was driven by global warming. It was driven by massive carbon dioxide releases from an eruption, a volcanic eruption in Siberia. And the big question is, can 7 billion people burning fossil fuels for a couple of centuries produce the same rise in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases that happened during the Permian extinction with just a simple lava flow in Siberia? And increasingly, scientists, particularly geologists, are starting to say, yes, it's a very real possibility. And so it becomes more and more urgent that we actually do something about this and stop this nonsense of clean coal and natural gas is wonderful, and anything that comes out of the Earth, where the carbon has been stored in the Earth for hundreds of millions of years and now it's being burned and put into the atmosphere, any of that is bad.
So, I don't think Obama is doing enough.
No, he's not. He's not even close to doing enough. And you know, members of Congress are not doing enough. The American people are not demanding enough. And in large part, that's because you've got a fossil fuel industry, from the Koch brothers to ExxonMobil to others, who have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in aggregate over the years and decades denying the actual science and creating this phony controversy. Did you know that every single Republican who was elected to the freshman class, newly elected to the House of Representatives in the 2010 and 2012 elections, every single one of them believes that climate change is not happening, that it's not, at least that it's not caused by man-made activity? It's mind-boggling. I mean, these guys are coming in with money from these industries. They are bought and paid for. And it's become an article of faith. And then you've got Fox News, right-wing talk radio. You've got entire news medias that are dedicated to denying science. So it is a dangerous, dangerous thing, Janet. This is very different than denying that the Earth is 5 billion years old and saying it's only 6,000 years old. You can do that. You know, if you can talk about people with dinosaurs if you want. And this is very different than the Scopes monkey trial, saying that, you know, evolution didn't happen. Those things, those kinds of beliefs won't destroy the Earth. But we've got beliefs now that are being propagated, and they're purely belief systems. They're not based in science at all. That global warming is not being caused by humans, that it's caused by sunspots, that it's cyclical, that, you know, all these things, and where they take a little bit of truth and they turn it into a very, very big lie, that are actually putting this planet, putting all of us and all of our aunts, all of our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren at great risk. Janet, thank you for the call, and thanks for raising the issue, giving me an opportunity to riff on it. Like I said, watch this spot. At the end of the summer, we will be talking about this very, very loudly and with a lot of detail. We're pulling it together right now. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Wednesday in the summer. Anything Goes Summer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the Keystone Pipeline. Oh, Jim is on the line. He's at Ground Zero in Keystone. This will be interesting. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on. There's a lot going on in the world. This is a great time to check in with a news service. This Talk Radio News Service brought to you, by the way, by the magic of Hungary at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. You can learn more about the Hungary program with the Hungarian Heritage Roots to Revival app and at folklife.hu. Bob Ney with the great Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. It's always nice to hear your voice. I understand you're back from India.
I'm back.
From hanging out with His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
That's it. It was very peaceful.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, boy, what a good life. So what's going on in the world?
Well, Mohamed Morsi is no longer, they don't know where he's at, but he's decrying, you know, this whole thing and how bad it is. But I was very fascinated to see what the military actually said, that they are responding to the millions of Egyptians who had opposed the Islamic agenda of Dr. Morsi.
Yeah.
And they put a constitutional interim head. They did disband the Constitution, which, you know, had to occur. I view it as positive. The Obama administration is, quote, not taking sides. I know, you know, John McCain and his allies are going to beat their fists down and, you know, we got to do something. We're doing the right thing. I think it's a positive sign. I really do.
Yeah.
Not
I think
military
that
coups, but, you know.
Well, yeah. And in fact, what provoked this in part was that Morsi and his buddies have been rolling back the rights of women. You have
a lot of
women and family and men who have women in their families who are really, really upset about it. And I'm just wondering if what we're seeing happen in Texas and Ohio and all around the country here in the United States, where the rights of women are being diminished, and it's not just with regard to abortion, but a whole spectrum of things, that I don't expect a military coup here or anything, but this kind of overreach by the men doesn't always turn out well.
Well, the voting rights recently. You know,
yeah, another one.
Like by the Supreme Court. You know, is another one. And maybe we ought to take the Congress, Tom, of America and put him in Egypt for a month and see how people react.
Can you imagine John Boehner in Egypt?
He'll be crying for legitimate reasons.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, you know, the Islamists want to do away with drinking. John Boehner would have a real problem with that.
That's right.
Whew.
Oh, it'd be terrible.
Yeah. So, anyway, what else is up?
Well, that and the big talk of the town. Of course, they're out of town, but I'm just watching the conservatives' reaction to this. The president has given a break till 2015 to the business community. Now, of course, the
with regard to Obamacare.
Yes, and the individual is not going to have that break. I just thought it was fascinating. I think it's more politics of it. And all of a sudden, a couple of the Republicans are saying, you know, he can't implement this program. Now, they are happy that business got a break. Let's face it, till 2015. But I think that if individuals have to pay into the system and really if the Obama administration now has to focus on getting people into health care that don't have it, or this is going to get a bit haywire because the businesses are going to get a little bit of a break till 2015.
Right. I think that this is Obama taking small business, complaining about a new and unnecessary burden. And there will be right-wing-owned small businesses who will be screaming to the rooftops about Obamacare when the employer mandate kicks in. I think this is him taking that off the agenda for the 2014 elections.
That's exactly what I've been saying all day. This is a political move.
Nothing more, nothing less.
That's it. It's a political move. Now, on the other hand, the Chamber of Commerce has gotten what it wants, so it can't come back because it didn't ask, you know, it's asked for some help on tweaking the rules, so they can't come back now and say, well, do away with it. They've gotten their, quote, help on tweaking the rules.
Yeah.
But I do believe it's a political move, the 2014 midterm elections. The president probably had some pressure from within some higher ranks of the Democratic circle.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it's a move. It's a political move.
Yep. I agree. And in a much smaller way, it's a sad testimonial to the very poor messaging that the Obama administration has done in terms of getting this thing implemented on the one hand. And on the other hand, it's a testimonial to the efficiency with which Republicans, particularly Republican governors in red states, have been sabotaging Obamacare.
Well, they have to come to terms, too, with the fact it's going to be here. It's not going to be wiped out. I don't care who is going to run this government. It's going to be around. It might get tweaked. It might put off for a bit. But these states are going to have to come up to terms because, yes, they have been able to exercise some muscle on it. But eventually it makes a hybrid system state by state that's not going to be very workable for people. So the red states, at the end of the day, this is coming one way or the other someday.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you would think the same thing was true of unemployment benefits, but North Carolina just kicked 600,000 people off long-term unemployment by saying...
I don't know how they survive doing that. I mean, the state itself.
Yeah, I think that you've got a corporate-controlled media in North Carolina. Most people don't have any idea what the Republicans have done in that state. Most of the voters are not paying attention. It's the 4th of July. They're going to go out and party. They're looking at sports games, and they're looking, at if they're watching TV, they're watching what's happening with the Trayvon Martin trial or what's going on in Egypt or whatever. It's just not much being discussed, and I'm just astounded. But, they're getting away with it.
Terrible.
I mean, look at what they did in Michigan. They did away with democracy in Detroit. And
people, unfortunately, more interested in the trials on TV.
I thought that when Rick Snyder put a dictator in charge of Detroit that there would be, people on the streets, and it didn't happen. I mean, there was a couple thousand. But anyhow, back to the news. What else is going on in the world?
Well, those are the two biggest items. Now, James Clapper from the National Intelligence Center apologized for, misspeaking or whatever.
For lying to Congress.
Yeah, misspeaking or, lying or misstating or whatever they do about lying to Congress. Well, as a former congressman, too, I can't believe some of the members who say, oh, my goodness. Now, come on. A lot of people, after the Patriot Act, knew these things were occurring, could occur, and would occur.
In other words, there's a large element of gambling in Casablanca?
Hard to believe.
Yes.
We're actually spying on people, and nobody monitored the FISA court to do checkups of, how do they really proceed.
But, feigned outrage or not, isn't the big question going forward, are we going to start having some oversight?
The FISA court, which, I didn't vote for the Patriot Act, but I did support having a FISA court because we had to do something once that monster came in. Somebody's got to start looking at it.
Yeah, I agree. Former Congressman Bob Ney, reporting for the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the Magic of Hungary, the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, the Heritage Roots to Revival app at folklife.hu. Bob, thank you for being with us today.
Happy Fourth.
Always great talking to you. Happy Fourth to you too, sir. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. According to a report released today by the United Nations, the world suffered through unprecedented climate extremes between 2000 and 2010. And these are the last years that we have the numbers for. We had a caller earlier going, look at this website that he promoted on the air that says that, there's been no climate change. It's all sunspots. It's right. From Hurricane Katrina and Sandy here in the U.S. to epic heat waves in Europe and devastating floods in Australia and the Middle East, virtually every part of the globe was affected by global warming-induced extreme weather. This report, published by the UN's World Meteorological Organization, noted that every year of the decade ending in 2010, except for 2008, was among the 10 warmest since record keeping began in the 1850s. Now, wait a minute. I thought the Koch brothers told me that warming had leveled off. No. The WMO report also says that between 2000 and 2010, 370,000 people died worldwide as a result of extreme weather events, and that death rate is up 20% from the 1990s, the decade before. Now, the good news is that a lot of countries around the globe are doing their part to fight the biggest threat that our planet has ever faced. Countries like Germany are leading the way when it comes to producing clean and green renewable sources of energy, while China, America's biggest competitor, has already rolled out a cap-and-trade program in Shenzhen, one of that nation's largest industrial cities, as a test for the entire nation. Unfortunately, you can't say the same thing about the United States of America. We're doing squat. It's because politicians in Washington are doing absolutely nothing to curb climate change or to prevent future devastating superstorms and extreme weather events. In fact, all of the recently elected Republicans in the House of Representatives say that they doubt humans are causing global climate change, despite mountains of research and studies proving otherwise. If you don't believe me, just ask freshman Republican Congressman Jim Bridenstine, or Stein, Jim Bridenstine of Oklahoma. On the House floor last month, the freshman congressman demanded that President Obama apologize to Oklahomans for allocating federal funding to climate change research. Bridenstine said that, "Here's what we absolutely know. We know that Oklahoma will have tornadoes when the cold jet stream meets the warm Gulf air, and we also know that this president spends 30 times as much money on global warming research as he does on weather forecasting and warning. For this gross misallocation, the people of Oklahoma are ready to accept the president's apology, and I intend to submit legislation to fix this." End of quote. Bridenstine is proof that if you're a big oil company or a shill for the fossil fuel industry, buying off a Republican lawmaker is the best investment you can make. As the website opensecrets.org points out, Bridenstine and other climate change denying Republican lawmakers have received a small fortune in campaign donations from some not so climate change friendly groups. According to opensecrets.org, during the 2013 campaign cycle, Bridenstine alone received money from ExxonMobil, Latshaw Drilling, WPX Energy, Chesapeake Energy, Devon Energy, and Koch Industries. In fact, all of them were in his top 20 donors. For some big oil bankrollers, simply buying off Washington politicians isn't enough. That's where the Koch brothers, two of the fossil fuel industry's biggest friends, come in. Through their Americans for Prosperity front group, the Koch brothers have succeeded in getting politicians from Congress and state officials to sign on to a Grover Norquist-like pledge. But instead of pledging not to raise taxes, these lawmakers have pledged to block any legislation that might lead to cap and trade or a carbon tax unless it's accompanied by an equivalent amount of spending cuts. Right. The pledge, known officially as the No Climate Tax Pledge, was created by the very same men whose very own companies, this is the Koch brothers, emitted over 24 million tons of carbon dioxide in 2011, according to the EPA. So it should come as no surprise that the Koch brothers want to protect their so-called right to pollute our environment and their so-called right to do irreversible damage to our planet. More than 400 Republican lawmakers in Washington and across the country have signed on to this pledge, promising to, quote, oppose any legislation relating to climate change that includes a net increase in government revenue, end of quote. That number of shills who have signed on includes 76 Republican freshman congressmen, the entire GOP House leadership, and just about every Republican lawmaker in the state of Wisconsin, including Governor Scott Walker. Nearly a quarter of the U.S. senators have also signed on to the Koch brothers' pledge. I thought we were over it with the pledges already. I mean, once again, you got millionaires and billionaires corrupting our democracy, buying off our politicians, putting money and greed ahead of the well-being of the American people, and in this case, frankly, ahead of the well-being of this entire planet. You know, we just can't continue to let billionaires like the Koch brothers buy off politicians left and right while everyone else is left to suffer. Some issues are bigger than politics, and the fate of the only planet that we can call home is certainly one of them. It's time once and for all to get money out of politics, because if we don't, the end of the world and life as we know it may be just down the road. Go to movetoamend.org, an organization with which I have no affiliation whatsoever, but they are. This is the tip of the spear to produce change. Movetoamend.org to reclaim your voice in our American democracy and thus help to save our planet. Meanwhile, in Egypt, the coup is complete. Mr. Morsi has been taken to an undisclosed location. At the same time, Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia? No. Ecuador. Yeah, the president of Ecuador is, like, really, really steamed that... The first story was out that his plane was diverted. He was leaving Russia. He was going back to Ecuador. That his plane was diverted and he had to land in Vienna, Austria, and have his plane searched. Excuse me, Bolivia. Bolivia. I'm mixing up my South American countries. It's been a long week. And Mr. Morales is like, you know, steamed about this. And now the countries, now Spain and France are saying, no, we didn't say that he couldn't, you know. So who's pulling the strings? Looks like it's the United States. And then he was tweeting out about how, you know, they don't have the legal right to search my plane, and there's some news reports that they did search his plane, and where is Snowden, and nobody knows, and it's very, very interesting. Very interesting. Michael in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. We've got a minute to the break, Michael. It's yours. What's up?
Oh, you wouldn't believe, Tom. I work in the oil industry, and you just have no idea how far their evil fingers reach. I mean, you're talking about the CO2 in the atmosphere and the climate change. You're right on, but that is nothing compared to what they really do. I mean, they are in everything. You're talking about every single industry you can get into, not just politics, but oil is in everything that we use.
Sure.
I mean, talking about... I mean, anything from you burning candles. I mean, you're talking about getting away from natural gas to power our electricity or anything like that. I'd love to do that, turn off the power plants and then go to just burning candles. But unfortunately...
So the candles are made out of paraffin, which is made out of oil.
Yeah, exactly. It's made out of paraffin, which comes right out of oil. It gets even worse. You have the stuff that comes out of the ground whenever they bring the oil out of the ground. It's not just oil and natural gas, but... to H2S, and I was out on the field the other day, and this stuff is lethal that they have out in the field. And I mean, just a whiff of this stuff.
Poisonous hydrogen sulfide, that is, isn't it?
That is exactly right.
Yeah, it's amazing. Michael, thank you for the call. Give us a shout one of these times when we got a little bit more time and fill us in more detail. I appreciate it. Thank you. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And in the Trayvon Martin trial, the prosecution is resting their case as we speak, if they haven't just already finished. Very interesting note over a Democratic Party. If only our glorious leaders would put as much effort into making people's lives better. If the amount of money that has gone into spying on us had instead gone into a national health care program, had instead gone into free college education for all Americans, we frankly would not need to be spying on other people. I mean, you know, life would be good, and we could stop with all the military bases all over the world and stop with a highly interventionist foreign policy and simply say, you know, we're going to do like Canada. We're going to do like Sweden. We're going to do like Norway. We're going to do like Denmark. We're going to do like Finland. We're going to protect ourselves and take care of ourselves. But instead, we're protecting our billionaires, we're taking care of the transnational corporations, and we're spying on each other. Really? This is nuts. Bill in Crown Point, Indiana, listening on WCPT. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Take off the speakerphone, please.
We're talking about Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland, Ohio. Are you familiar with that?
Only marginally. Inform me and our audience, Bill.
Okay. It's just something that Cleveland, Ohio has started. It's depressed neighborhoods who have for-profit businesses that they're employee-owned. And it's just an amazing thing, actually. And I thought that you, having the microphone, should know about it.
Okay, who is promoting these? How do they come about?
The federal government with local governments in Cleveland, Ohio, have started this, and it's people in a very low-income neighborhood who are the people who are the employee owners. But the amazing thing is they start out at $8 an hour, and that's for 6 months. And then they can get voted out by people if they don't hold
right. This is typically how it works in a co-op, that you have a period of time to see if you work out with everybody in a kind of a probationary period.
Exactly. So what's fascinating is, so then it goes up to $10.50 an hour, and 50 cents goes into their ownership buy-in fund.
Right.
And then what's projected is, and what's amazing is, and this is a very low income, like a median wage is $18,000 in this neighborhood. After, 8 to 10 years, they are projected to have like $60,000-$70,000 of ownership value. So that's, to me, what's amazing about this.
Right. So they're building wealth as well as generating income.
Exactly right, Tom, and that's why I called you, because I thought you would want to know about this.
I love it. I profiled in my book Threshold the Union Cab Company up in Madison and the Peninsula Machine Tool Company, or they make precision machines, and these are both co-ops, and there's a whole bunch of co-ops in the Madison area that we talked about, and there's a whole movement across the United States, and there's a trade organization for them. I was unaware that the federal and state governments were doing specific projects in Cleveland, Ohio. If you have a link to a story about that, if you go to tomhartman.com on our front page blog, my daily blog, if you could just plug the link in there so that I can track it down, I'd appreciate that, Bill.
Okay, I will, and I think I already did that, but if you didn't get it, it's just Evergreen. Just Google Evergreen Cooperative Laundry, because the laundry is the first business that is successful. And
okay.
I would hope that you would look into that, because it is a great thing.
Okay. I just made a L-A-U-N-D-R-Y. I just made a note to myself, too, because I can't do it while I'm on the air here, but when I get off, I will. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for heads up.
Thank you very much.
Much appreciated. I'm telling you, we have the smartest listeners on earth. It is such a pleasure to share time with you folks. David in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, David, you work in the oil and gas industry?
Yes, I do. I've been working in it actually for about 25 years. First of all, I want to personally apologize to all the listeners out there for Jim Brendenstein and Jim Inhofe and Tom Colburn. You know, we try to elect people, but they've got, we've got so many people that are so twisted with the rhetoric that you hear nonstop from the shiny people in the magic box that it's almost impossible to get any kind of reasoned arguments out there. So that's where we get these right-wingers. CO2 problem, something that's been a special interest of mine for the last decade. And I have been an advocate of putting gas plants into the gas plants to pull out the CO2 out of the stream, and then to use something like the Bloom Energy servers, the Yeoman oxide solid fuels instead of for your regeneration, for your dehydration. So that would also pull out. You get the heat, you get the electricity out of it. Plus, it uses the natural gas.
The big problem, how do you sequester that carbon dioxide, David?
The CO2. First of all, and as far as I'm concerning myself, is just liquefaction of the CO2, so you can handle it.
Right.
You can't do anything with it.
Need to convert it to a solid by like bonding it to calcium or something to turn into calcium carbonate.
Certainly. And, that could be a whole branch unto itself.
Right.
I'm thinking more about the immediate problem of what do you do. You know, you look at all the alternative energies are problematic.
Mm.
And I'm all for them. You know, I'd love to have solar cells on my roof. In fact, I've got a couple. Mm. And, heat pumps, windmills, wave generators, geothermals, take old abandoned oil wells and drop a line down it, because anything below 5,000 feet, every 10 feet, you get a degree, so you can use those as heat pumps. But the problem is, even if today we said, we're going to stop, we're stuck, we still can't get off the oil and gas treadmill. We still have to have natural gas to heat homes, to make medicines, to make plastics.
But using it to make medicines and plastics is not anything close to the, you know, as carbon intensive on the atmosphere as using it to make power.
Oh, certainly. You know, there's argument that this stuff is worth too much to burn.
Yeah. David, we got to wrap it up, but give me a call another time. Let's get into this a little more. And because I'm fascinated by the idea of carbon sequestration, and I have not seen a good technology for it yet.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And one of the big problems is how much energy it takes to pull out the carbon dioxide and then, you know, to maintain it. If you're talking about liquid carbon dioxide, maintain it as cold as it is. Hey, for tonight's Politically Incorrect, I bring you conservative pundit Les Kinsolving. In a Monday column for WorldNet Daily titled, I'm with Scalia, not the Zoophiliacs, Les Kinsolving asks, which of 30 sexual orientations will demand marriage next? Kinsolving argued that the Supreme Court's decision to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act will, you guessed it, lead to the legalization of pedophilia, necrophilia, and zoophilia-type marriages. In other words, now that gay people can get the same tax benefits as straight couples, get ready for your cousin to marry his dog. Les wrote, consider the great joy of members of NAMBLA, which was allowed to march men with their small boy lovers in gay parades in both New York and San Francisco. End quote. Right. That didn't happen. Among the many other alternate sexual orientations that may well be counted upon to cite the Supreme Court decision, he says, are the incestuous, the necrophiliacs, providing the properly and healthily preserve their corpses, and the zoophiliacs, who practice bestiality, providing this form of sexual expression is applied only to freely consenting beasts. Here's the problem, Les. Children can't sign contracts in the United States, animals can't sign contracts in the United States, and dead people can't sign contracts in the United States, and marriage is a contract. So you can kiss the possibility of beast and boy marriages goodbye. You'd think somebody like Les Kinsolving, somebody who's supposedly an authority on these sort of things, would be smart enough to understand that, but apparently not. Les Kinsolving, you've been politically corrected. Michigan, a federal judge in Michigan who has been, Judge Bernard Friedman, who had been put on the bench by Ronald Reagan, has said that a case challenging the Constitution, the federal constitutionality of Michigan's constitutional amendment that was passed back in 2004 banning gay marriages, that case can go forward in federal court. This could be the case that cracks open all the states that have banned gay marriage. There are a couple of nurses in a Detroit suburb who not only want to be married, but they want to adopt the three children that one of them have together as a married couple. And this federal judge said, okay, let's do it. Let's have it on. And in fact, he pointed to the DOMA case and said, this case tells us that we need to reconsider all this stuff. I mean, I'm paraphrasing badly, but very interesting. Same-sex couples are also suing in Nevada, Illinois, Hawaii, and New Jersey. This is going to move fast. You know, when Ellen was here the day that it happened, Ellen Ratner, who herself is gay married, and she was saying, you know, it's going to be five, and has been involved in the gay rights movement literally since the 70s. And Ellen was like, you know, it's probably going to be about 5 years. I think it's going to be about 1 year, maybe two. I think it's going to happen really fast. Peter, It's Anything Goes Summer, by the way, Wednesday here. Peter, listening to WCPT in Roselle, Illinois. What's up? You want to talk about George Zimmerman?
Yes, you were asking how George Zimmerman got his bloody nose if Trayvon Martin didn't hit him.
Right.
And I know you and your listeners might think I'm trying to make a joke because it's going to sound funny, but I'm perfectly serious.
Okay.
It's called recoil.
You know,
he shot that gun with one hand and it came back and punched him in the face.
If he was holding it in front of his face when he shot it, that actually makes perfect sense because recoil.
Right, your previous guest or you had on there talking about it said that the hammer needed to be pulled back.
Right.
So he pulled back with one hand. He was in a hurry, so he shot that gun with one hand right in front of his face. It came back up and punched him right in the nose.
Yeah. That actually makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot more sense than that he smashed his nose into the concrete because his nose didn't have the kind of that would have caused significant scraping. And I think it's really hard for a person to punch themselves in the face hard enough to break their nose. And he didn't have anybody around who could help him out. That's the only reasonable explanation that anybody has offered so far, Peter. I think you're right.
Yeah. I think so.
I think you're right. And what was the cat? It was a 9mm weapon, wasn't it?
I don't know what the final, but either way, the prosecutor came out and they said they had pull that hammer back manually.
Yeah, yeah.
He pulled that hammer back with whatever hand that he's not, you know, if he's a right-handed, he pulled it back with his left hand, and he's in a hurry. Obviously, there is a scuffle going on.
Yeah.
He pulled that hammer back, pulled that trigger, and punched himself right in the nose.
Yeah, yeah, with the back of the gun or with his thumb if it was up there. Yeah, makes perfect sense, and I wonder if the gun has been examined for blood or DNA.
Well, only for Trayvon Martin's DNA. I don't know if they tested it for his Zimmerman.
Yeah, yeah. That would be very interesting to see if there was any of his blood on that gun, and because that you could construct the scenario. I mean, where's David Caruso when you need him? Right? I mean, you could construct the scenario to answer that, and I think that makes perfect sense. I'll tell you, my brother's got a .40 caliber handgun, and now that's a much bigger bullet, than a 9mm bullet. But that thing's got so much kick that after a couple of shots on that thing, my hand hurts. I mean, I've actually had bruises on my hand from firing my brother's .40 caliber pistol, and I believe he's got a 9mm. In fact, I think it's a Sig Sauer, and that's got kick. I mean, you know, 9mm would be enough to break your nose if you were holding it right in front of you and there was nothing to brace that. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Peter, thank you very much for that. I think you're right. Keith in Bentonville, Arkansas, the home of the Walmart, the eggplant that ate Chicago.
Yes, it is.
Hey, Keith.
Hello, Tom.
Thanks for listening on the Tom Hartman app. What's up?
Oh, well, I have to listen to it on the app or on iHeart because you're not on a radio station around here. It's pretty much deep within the heart of, feel like an insurgent behind enemy lines sometimes.
I can imagine. So what's up?
But, hey, just want to let you know there are a few good progressives down here in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Good.
And to take your advice of tag, you're it, that, you got to get pretty inventive down here because mm-hmm. Putting a progressive bumper sticker on your car can get your car keyed or tire slashed. And so, like I said, it's more like an insurgency sometimes. And one thing that's worked really well for me was you can't go on Facebook under your own name and get real progressive. So one of the things that some of us have done have just made up extra Facebook accounts so that way we can connect with each other and not have repercussions from friends and family and coworkers that don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
And it works really well to link up with other progressives, and mine is called Progressive Brummy.
Okay.
And one of the things that I've done is you ever go into a store and they're playing Fox News on the TV and you just have to grin and bear it and buy your stuff and get out of there?
Yeah, it's happened to me a few times, and a couple of times I've actually went up and said, I really object to the Fox News being on the TV. Could you put it on at least CNN, some, a station that doesn't have an overt bias? And
right.
You know, once they did it, and once they basically said, sorry, it's the boss's decision and I have no control over it. And most of the time, I have to admit, I haven't had the time or the courage to do it.
Right. And I've done that before. You know, being in the South, it's on everywhere. Everywhere
yeah.
you go. And sometimes I've had confrontations to where I was just wanting to say, hey, you know, I don't appreciate it. And, you know, some people don't really want to be smacked in the face with politics just when they go in to get something to drink, you know.
Right. Right.
And other times people were real understanding. But what I came up with was just get some business cards printed out. You can get it done really cheap online, you know, Vista prints or whatever, and just put it on the counter. And it just you can type in there whatever message you want. The one I've got says, I came here to be your customer today, but because you have Fox News on the radio or on the TV or whatever, I chose to leave, and you lost out on a sale. And
wow.
I put that on my Facebook page, and I've had a lot of people comment on it and ask for some of the cards, and I've been mailing them out to people for them to use, but it's just as easy for people to make their own and have their own, you know, personal message.
Right. That's great.
And if enough businesses, hit them in the pocketbook and let them know that you're hitting them in the pocketbook, because if you just do it anonymously and leave without saying anything, they never know they lost a sale.
Yeah, 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 you're right. Keith, excellent point. Excellent point, and good on you for your activism. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. And good luck with your Facebook page. Sarah in Young America, Minnesota. Hey, Sarah, thanks for listening to KTNF. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Longtime listener. Really appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I recently learned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
And I understand it's a secretive bill that they'll be voting on this October.
Mm-hmm.
And my summation of the little bit that I do know about it, to me, it almost sounds as though it's a fast track to almost like a fascist dictatorship.
I believe
so. And the small understanding that I also have is that it would erode labor protection laws.
Yes.
So if we're, you know, and I look at that like it could be a pathway to just a horrible labor situation for
yep.
everyone across the world.
Labor protection laws, environmental protection laws, right across the board. It's a corporate takeover of America.
Yes, so I just wanted your feedback, but thank you.
Certainly. Thank you for the call, Sarah. Yeah, this is, fascism is defined by Mussolini as the merger of corporate and state interests, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership is very much that, and the Obama administration is trying to fast-track this thing so Congress cannot amend it and probably can't even basically read it. We'll see how this plays out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, Bill Clinton got away with it. Bush got some through. Obama has actually passed a couple of these trade agreements. But this is like going back to Clinton. This is like the mother of them all. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Benjamin in Fort Worth, Texas. You are a geophysicist?
Yes, sir. I just wanted two things. Want to make a comment.
Mm-hmm.
One, and then just kind of say about the CO2 process. You use a cryogenic process to kind of convert, all the CO2 that's produced at the wellhead into a liquid, you know, which then you could get rid of it and dispose of it properly. But
you super cool the stuff and the CO2 condenses out as a liquid. But then what do you do with it? I mean, as soon as it gets above a couple hundred degrees minus Fahrenheit, it's going to turn back into a gas, isn't it? I mean, you have to figure out a way to turn it into a solid at room temperature.
We don't put it in the ocean, and then we cool it back off.
No, the problem with, you know, right now, the pH of the ocean in the last 40 years has gone down by one-tenth of a point. And as you know, the pH scale is a log scale. You now have parts of the ocean where the zooplankton, the bottom of the food chain animals, and even the more complex ones, the corals, can't survive because they can't reproduce. Well, you know, these are animals that have 60, 70, 80, in some cases 90% of their body mass calcium. And that as the pH becomes more acidic, the ability of them to both render calcium out of the water and to excrete it into their own shells is diminished. They're not able to survive.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm very sorry. I guess you couldn't see my. I'm totally joking about the.
Oh, I see.
In the ocean.
Okay, so what do you do?
One thing. Well, I don't. As far as what do? I don't know. But here's the big issue. You know, if we can get it out, CO2. And
sure.
The problem is that it makes the gas price so high it's non-economical anymore. And
right.
So the real question is if you got high prices, everybody gripes. And the real problem is how do we get from out from under this into something else? I mean, what is the next sustainable deal? I don't think. I think the problem is there's nowhere to go. You know, without some type of new technology.
Well, no, I think we've got bridge technologies right now. 20% of all the electricity in Texas and 21% of all the electricity in Iowa right now, today, are produced by wind.
Yeah, but here's the problem with the wind is, you know, we're talking about some wind things. I mean, you're right. It's a good deal, but it's non-cost prohibitive. In Texas, you know, you can pay, you know, I personally purchased the wind-powered electricity, but it cost me a time and a half. What,
yeah.
Coal and everything
but see,
else?
If the cost of that carbon dioxide that is in that those fossil fuels that we're using for, to power our power plants, if the cost of that carbon, the real genuine cost of that carbon dioxide was being paid by the fossil fuel industry, then the normal your normal electricity and other energy production costs would go up by time and a half, and then the alternative fuels become very attractive economically. The only reason that fossil fuels are cheap is because we're subsidizing them and we're letting the fossil fuel industry dump its waste into our atmosphere and not pay for it.
Well, to some extent, you're exactly right. But, you know, the other side of the deal is I don't believe that we have enough technology. I mean, there's some bridges out there, some bridge technology that kind of
consider
it's not enough to make
You know, the major use of oil in the United States, 90% of the oil in the United States is used for transportation. It's used principally for cars and trucks. And
about 78%, but yeah.
78, okay. Thank you for correcting me. The majority of it, in any case, a very, very large, significant majority of it. And well over half, and some numbers indicate well over three-quarters of all Americans drive far less than 50 miles a day. And electric cars now have ranges of 200 and 300 miles on a charge. So having an electric car that you recharge at night is a no-brainer, and it's cheaper than – and if fossil fuels were more expensive and your electricity was being generated by either solar during the day and it's stored some way, breaking water into, you know, hydrolysis of water, or whether it's there's a variety of technologies that you can use to store it, batteries, I mean, you know, however it's done, or whether it's done by wind, which blows at night too, you now have an economy that works. They're doing this in Denmark right now. They were generating 18% of the electricity by wind, and now they're building a car factory. They put $5 billion in a building car factory for rechargeable cars. People will be able to sell the electricity in their battery back into the grid at, say, $7 or $8 a kilowatt hour, when they can buy it at night for $3 or $4 a kilowatt hour. People can use their cars as a giant national battery. You get a couple of million of these doing this, and you make up for the daily variation in electricity demand. So that 18% wind power can become 20, 25, 30% wind power, because the peak demand during the day is being met by the batteries in people's cars.
Tom, I'm on your team here, but here's the problem. If your electric cars, 83% of people are charging electric cars with coal.
Yeah. So we changed that. We changed that. We do what Germany did, and you put solar panels on everybody's rooftop.
Well, I agree with the direction you're heading, but I just don't see how.
The thing that will drive it is economics. The thing that will drive it, Benjamin, is money. And if the actual cost of the carbon pollution, not to mention the carcinogens and asthma and everything else that are coming out of fossil fuels, but just the cost of carbon dioxide, if we just took the cost of the superstorms, you know, the billions of dollars of damage that they're doing to our country every year, and said to the fossil fuel industry, this is called a carbon tax, you're going to pay for this stuff. Suddenly, the price of gasoline goes high enough that everybody wants an electric car. The price of electricity coming off the grid goes high enough that everybody wants to put solar panels on their roof. It becomes more economic. And local communities, particularly in areas where there's a lot of wind, want to put up, you know, windmills. It's happening all around the world. You've got all across India right now. They're leapfrogging carbon technology. They're ignoring. You've got villages that have never had electricity that are going right to solar power instantly. So, Benjamin, thanks for the call. I mean, it's a great conversation. We need to have more of it. Happy Independence Day from everyone here at the Tom Hartman Program. And when you're enjoying your holiday, tune in tomorrow for my rant about FDR's second Bill of Rights. Plus, what would the U.S. be like if Jimmy Carter had won a second term? That, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. Don't forget, democracy starts when you get active. Get out there. Show up. Tag, you're it. See you. See you next week. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.